Well, I don't Mr. think London. Really the efficiency or the inefficiency of the FBI is the real question. I'm willing to concede that they're efficient. I've seen some of their work, and it has
been... No, but I think Bill's point was... Efficiency.
I know.
The point was that their immunity to criticism rests in part on the picture which they have created in the public mind of their great efficiency in the matter which is mostly within their jurisdiction, namely crime detection and pursuit of the criminal.
Yes,
and that therefore, because of that, the public is willing to take on faith whatever they do in other areas, and that perhaps if one were aware that their picture of themselves as the great detectives of the world, so forth, wasn't altogether true, the public would be more willing to scrutinize their activities in other areas. Isn't that what you're saying?
This I would most certainly and most heartily agree with. I think that the...
It's relevant only in that way.
Yes, the real criticism is that the FBI, in order to perpetuate the present organization in its present form, has made a studied attempt to have the public believe that they are dedicated and of almost superhuman efficiency.
And this stems now, it becomes very important in the director's insistence that the local homegrown communists are one of our largest menaces, and that he needs more and more appropriation. I think has assigned almost one-third of his force to handling this situation and sent 1,500 agents into the party of 8,000 itself.
Well, I think that should be corrected slightly. Mr. Levine's charge was, I think, that there were 1,500 people in the Communist Party who were serving as informants.
Yeah, they're not all special agents.
There's a big difference.
People who were tipsters. But it seems to me
people
that,
on part-time pay, you might say.
The question of immunity from criticism, which Mr. Kunstler raised, does have a very direct bearing on the efficiency of an organization. It's at least in our democratic system, we assume that nothing operates very efficiently or effective very long if it is insulated from inspection, if it is protected from discussionism, because then it tends to breed on its own
dry rot
weaknesses and rot inside. And then by the time the inspection does take place, it may very often be too late. Mr. Frankel, you brought up a very interesting point some time ago about the racial attitudes of the agents, particularly with regard to the activities of the agents in the South in cooperating with local law enforcement officials. I think it might be interesting to take an example of a police force, and I'm not equating the New York City police force with the FBI because their functions are very different. But in the training of the New York police force under Commissioner Murphy, there is a great deal of emphasis placed on educating these police candidates to some of the realities about racial differences and attitudes and the problems that can arise in an integrated community. And I know that in my contacts with police officers in the part of the city that I live in, the west side of New York, I have found a great amount of sophistication on the part of many of the police there about this whole question. And it seems to me that perhaps this kind of training emphasis might very well be considered just as important for law enforcement officials in the federal government who are going to have to be dealing with these problems in communities where racial tensions are severe. So what do we do about the question of what is taking place in these training courses in the Federal Bureau of Investigation?
Well, I think one thing is true of New York that is not true of the FBI, and that is our commissioner here, Commissioner Murphy, has been very careful to instruct and require the police to recognize the civil rights of people who are apprehended and people with whom they deal. He has made a point, as his predecessor made a point, of insisting that this be done. It is not only a question of training, but a question of policy established at the very top. I don't know that this policy has been established by Mr. Hoover. We don't know that he has instructed his agents to recognize the civil rights of people whom they take into custody, or to recognize the civil rights of the people that they are dealing with constantly. We do know that in many cases the FBI has been guilty of violation of civil rights in one manner or another. This is the way that the courts have scrutinized.
Well, one of the things has been this business of rounding up people at early hours of the morning and things of that sort, and having mass arrests and a lot of newspaper publicity attendant on them, which may not really be necessary at all. But I think one of the difficulties in connection with the FBI in that area is that most agents are not in contact with the man in the street. The police in New York at least are constantly in contact with the population in New York. And the FBI people consider themselves as something special. They're the super force. And I think they're removed, therefore. That's a fault which needs correction. I don't know just how it can be done.
Well, of course, the other big difference is that if something goes wrong in a street corner in New York City between a policeman and a Negro or a white man or anybody else, there is a great hue and cry. There's perhaps a law case. There are a lot of politicians who jump into
That's
the breach
right.
with speeches, and the commissioner is called upon to investigate the matter, make a report to the mayor, and this is all done in broad daylight. Now, the situation is not this. We've seen the case of where these charges have been made by two ex-agents, but there has been no evidence that any congressman, for instance, has called for an investigation. It just doesn't seem to be a very popular thing to do.
There is such a thing, and again in New York, and I don't want to point this out as the perfect system or the ideal system, but there is a police complaint bureau. I think it's a very healthy thing. If any particular person, even if he be convicted of a crime, has some complaint about the way he has been handled by the police, a complaint can be made and it will be investigated. I can bear witness to the fact that such complaints are investigated, and they're investigated impartially. There isn't any such agency or bureau within the FBI that I know of, or if it exists, there certainly has been no attention paid to it that I know of.
Yes. Mr. Frankel, you were mentioning these mass arrests. I'm not sure I exactly understood in what connection you were speaking.
Well, there have been a number of occasions when people have been arrested in different parts of the country for conspiracy, violating one federal law or another, and arrested at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning in a great hullabaloo and so forth, somewhat reminiscent of the old Palmer raids of the 1920s, where Mr. Hoover, who was then not head of anything, got his first training, because he was in charge of those raids, as I believe.
Mr. Kunstler, what do you feel could be done to try to encourage a more procedural way of going at the problem of creating greater public confidence in the Federal Bureau of Investigation by having some sort of accountability system set up? Is there any possibility of this?
Mr. Lightfoot, I think it has probably the greatest public
confidence of any agency.
I don't think you have to worry about public confidence. I think my worry is more is whether that public confidence is well placed.
Absolutely. We should create a little bit of disturbance about the FBI rather than...
Well, I think
the question is whether the confidence is the public confidence is the result of a splendid publicity agency within the FBI, or whether it's the result of great work on their part, and I think all of us are inclined to believe that this is the work of experts.
We see the hand
who inculcate a certain attitude.
I do have a feeling, though, if you want to ask me, change the question somewhat and place it in this vein, what could what is wrong with the FBI as far as I can see, and I have a feeling, this, a lot of this is intuitive because we know so little about the FBI, except now for the first time you have two agents, two ex-agents, who are willing to involve themselves in protracted discussion about it. But even before I read Levine's report and Turner's, I have the feeling that the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation was beginning to see himself, as he developed over the years, as a kind of latter-day Savonarola. That what was more important to him than the individual is the fact that I think he feels that he is cutting out these moral sores in our social fabric. In fact, I was just looking over the introduction to Don Whitehead's The FBI Story, which is a very laudatory book about the FBI.
It a remarkable piece of objective analysis and investigation worthy of a reporter.
Well, all I can say is that in the foreword, Mr. Hoover says that we had full confidence in Mr. Whitehead. And I must say that their confidence was not misplaced. But in his foreword to the book, Mr. Hoover talks in terms of the moral chaos which exists in the United States, particularly after World War II. And I think he looks upon himself as the St. George that is out to go after this moral chaos and remove it. And I don't think, from my own observation, that he, in many instances, cares too much what the means are to achieve this result, that he's much more interested now in the result than the means. And I think when you reach this stage, you develop a highly efficient organization, that's true, but you get into the field where you're violating civil rights day in and day out for this greater, what you consider a greater goal. I don't think that it is a greater goal myself, but I know that Mr. Hoover, in the way he's taking Levine and Turner's reports, in the way he selects his people, and what he chastises them for, a man going to a nightclub without his wife, for example, or finding a half a bottle of Cutty Sark scotch in an agent's private quarters, these things seem to bother him a great deal. He's becoming, I think, the keeper of our morals in a great extent.
Well, Mr. Kunstler, this raises an interesting point about Mr. Hoover's latest communication to all his law enforcement officers. In this communication, the account of which I read in the newspapers, he attacked the courts for refusing to allow newspapers to print the names of juvenile offenders. And he went on to say that these juveniles were a bunch of, quote, beastly punks, unquote, who ought to be handled toughly and pretty savagely, and that in this role, Mr. Hoover is presuming to tell the judges on the bench about how to exercise their judicial responsibilities. And it also, I think, betrays some more of this sort of stern moralizing in areas which I find rather amazing for America's number one policeman to be entering.
Well, I think more than once in his role of St. George, to use Bill Kunstler's analogy, he has indicated that the Supreme Court has placed impediments in his way and prevented him from ridding the country of crime as he would like to if he hadn't been impeded by these restrictions that are placed on the conduct of his agents.
Well, of course, I think there again he's not alone. I think police chiefs all over have been critical of the Supreme Court's recent search and seizure decisions. That's a natural reaction on the part of law enforcement agents who see as their prime objective the detection and punishment of crime, and not too much concerned about the means they adopt to obtain those ends, and consider most of the constitutional restrictions as so much scraps of paper that they can ignore so long as they can get away with it. I don't think that's unique with respect to Hoover. I think it's unfortunate that Hoover also goes in for it simply because of the prominence that's given to everything that he says.
Bearing in mind that Hoover is the chief enforcement agent of the or officer of the Department of Justice, I think it is then questionable. I think the Department of Justice's role as critic of the Supreme Court, I don't think this is a proper role.
Well, I agree, but I...
And in this respect, he must be distinguished from the other police agents.
What you're suggesting is that the Attorney General should sit on Mr. Hoover when he does that and point out to him that the Attorney General's function is to protect the Constitution of the United States, and that Mr. Hoover should remember that. But no Attorney General has, so far as I know, and we've had some fairly eminent individuals in that position, ever publicly chastised Mr. Hoover. Do you remember any such instance?
No, there's just some rumor in Levine's that there's a conflict developing between Bobby Kennedy and the director on certain points, but that's about the most
that
I've seen.
We focused on the director, but I wonder if perhaps we ought not to discuss a little bit the public attitudes in this situation. What sort of civilization do we have where a man in Mr. Hoover's position can speak on almost any subject, religion, morality, justice, civil rights, and be regarded as almost a completely infallible authority by the general public, and whose statements on all of these issues, regardless of his particular professional background in these areas, accorded the kind of treatment that is usually only given to prime ministers.
Or the Pope.
Yes.
I might say this, Mr. Lyford. Actually, the organization has a great many defects in its infallibility. For example, we all know crime is increasing, and increasing in a greater ratio than other things, but one point that always bothered me was this. In 1956 or 57, every important hood in the country met at Joseph Barbera's home in Appalachian, New York. There wasn't an FBI agent alerted to this fact. No FBI agents that I know were present or knew, and this was a procession that came from every city in the United States. Vito Genovese was maybe one of the least of the barbecue visitors that day. Who found them? Who detected this? A sergeant of the state police in New York, and it led to that subsequent prosecution of 21 or 22,
which
fortunately resulted in a reversal. So I'm in quiver on my right here, but I'm not worried about the fact that in fact, I'm proud that the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit felt that the means was important to the end in that case by reversing those convictions. But what I'm getting at is this: that this was done not by the FBI. And they have great gaps where they do not function in a way that you would expect, certainly with 60 or 70 of these men coming to one place. You would assume that somewhere in the United States, some FBI agent of the 7 or 8,000 had some cognizance of this. This is one of several areas. I see that Ephraim is winding up.
I was just going to say that I can give you an instance where I feel a sense of personal grievance, and where I think the FBI was not only lax, but there was a duty on their part to have been more efficient, and that relates to Dr. Soblin. After all, he was convicted of a crime that the government felt was sufficiently serious that he could be condemned to life imprisonment. He was out on $100,000 bail. And yet, after his conviction was affirmed, there was no FBI agent watching him. He was able to walk around without nobody. He was not under surveillance. He was able to leave the country without the slightest interference.
Oh, I wondered about that, Mr. London, and I also wondered at the lack of criticism or protest or comment in the press about the failure. I didn't read any editorials saying, "Who let Soblin get out? Who's responsible?" Usually the newspapers could be expected to call for an investigation and get the
pretty silent. I've only seen it one place, in this month's November's issue of Esquire, and of all places, in Dwight McDonald's film criticism column, he wonders how Soblen could get out of the country with the FBI on his tail.
Which film was he commenting on?
I can't remember for the life of me.
May I say that in defense of the press, although this is hardly a defense, there were two other instances. WMCA did ask the question, where was the FBI when Soblen marched out of the country? And I believe the Post, or some columnist in the Post, made some comment. But I must say that this is only three instances. One would have expected an outcry.
There were no angry congressmen or indignant senators.
Oh. And had this been any other police force in the United States, I think the criticism would have been sky high. If the New York police had been assigned to guard Soblen, and he had gotten away, Murphy's head would have rolled, and I think everyone here understands that. But with Soblen, he goes to an airport, he has his brother's passport, a little slightly different name, he goes to an open airport the day following the denial of his appeal in the Supreme Court. He was a man who was classified as one of the master spies, for example. Seemed to me he'd be watched constantly the day before he's supposed to go to jail.
Well, while
as
you're
to
on
who his mantle is passed on to.
While you're on the Soblen case, I suppose the FBI was even worse off, because when he was deported from Israel, he was in the company of an FBI person who presumably was supposed to keep tabs on him.
He was in the care of the Chief United States Marshal.
Mr. McShane.
Oh, yes, this was not an FBI agent.
I take it back.
Speaking about the Soblen case, though, there's just one other matter, I think, of interest, which is an indication of some of the methods that are followed by the FBI. There was one witness there, as a matter of fact, the government's chief witness, who was unquestionably a man of unsound mind, emotionally disturbed, and a layman would describe him as insane. I have no hesitation in describing
him. Soblen's brother.
Soblen's brother. Now, this man was questioned by the FBI, and I saw the records of the questioning. I found it most interesting that he was questioned, asked virtually the same questions, and asked to repeat the same story 66 times. I find this most significant where you have a witness of unsound mind. Every practicing lawyer knows that you never go over a witness's story more than two or three times unless you find some discrepancy, and then you try to find out what the discrepancy is. When you go over 66 times, the whole procedure is suspect, and particularly where you have a man who, as this particular one, was a man whose memory was so impaired that he never knew whether he was telling the truth or not about his recollection.
Gentlemen, the question which I asked a little while ago, I feel, didn't get quite a fair shake, because I said that I felt that rather than focus completely on the FBI and the director's attitudes and his public relations program, that we ought to try to figure out what it is about the American public, at least insofar as the Bureau is concerned, which makes it so susceptible to almost any sort of public statement in this direction. Do you think that, why is this? Why our American people are pretty skeptical about lots of things, about the pretensions to perfection in all other areas. Why is it that there isn't more tendency to look with some skepticism upon this particular situation with regard to the FBI? Why, for instance, no matter whether Mr. Hoover is speaking about our morals, how to raise our children, the advisability of whether or not to go to Sunday school, the treatment of juvenile offenders, the question of how you handle convicts, how the judges ought to behave in court, on almost any of these subjects, he's accepted with a singular lack of criticism.
But remember, he's come into the picture in two or three different periods in our national development where he's come as a godsend. For example, I think his greatest development in the public image or the public eye occurred during the Dillinger days, during the mobsters in Chicago and the country and everywhere else for that matter, when people in this country were really genuinely alarmed and with good reason about the operations of a Capone and a Dillinger and a Pretty Boy Floyd. And when he created this public enemy concept, where he'd create a list of the 10 most wanted men and then proceed to eliminate them one by one, usually with the local police doing a lot of the work, too,
isn't
of course.
Isn't this the case in the Dillinger?
Well, the Dillinger, the claim is, of course, that the police around the that tracked him to the Lyric Theater, and the woman in red who turned him in, she had more to do with it than J. Edgar Hoover. But what I want to say is this, that this first period, which ended, I think, probably just before World War II, when the last of the public enemies, now they're down to little Nussbaum, who doesn't have the character or stamina of a Pretty Boy Floyd. But in those days, I think he filled a great public need. And now he's changed the need as
well,
the world situation
changed.
Now it's the communist.
But to take that point that you just raised, Hoover was the national figure tied in with Mr. A here and Mr. B there and Mr. C there, and the various local police who may have cooperated or even done most of the work in these areas were not nationally known and had no national place to be spoken of. And I think that accounts for it as much as anything else.
Well, to answer your question, I don't think the American public is at fault. I think that they have been fed for so many years with statements, many of which had their source in the FBI, that were favorable to the FBI, and receiving no criticism, hearing no criticism, no criticism being publicized, it's quite normal to expect that the public would begin to believe these statements and would begin to accept them. And now that there has been an image created, and it's going to be very difficult for the public to evaluate Hoover or the FBI objectively.
Perhaps the real question is, why has Congress been so quiescent? And there are, of course, many ugly reports that one reason why congressmen are so quiescent is that they're afraid that Hoover may have something on them because of the various dossiers that have been collected about almost everybody.
Well, I think perhaps even more than that, it's not so much a question of a congressman being afraid that there's something in his past that might embarrass him, but simply that if a congressman becomes known as a critic of any practices of the FBI, this becomes a very difficult thing for him with his constituency when he tries to run for re-election.
Well,
because he can be depicted as an enemy of our bureau, and he can be the enemy of a very respectable person in our society, and this can be a great political liability to him.
There also might be a dossier about him.
Yeah, well, that's what I was
with
suggesting.
The bureau. Could be embarrassing. One point that to get around again to answering your question. What do we have? 1 minute. I just would like to indicate that there's never really been a thorough, objective study of the FBI. Whitehead's book, of course, is so much the other way that you can't read it as anything more than a publicity job. But there ought to be, and Mr. Hoover says he invites it. He invites objectivity in a study, but would a Fred Cook be invited in to do
Mr.
a study?
Mr. Hoover, I don't believe, has ever held a press conference.
Of course, Max Lowenthal made a study of the FBI in its early years, but that only really covered the early years and doesn't deal with anything sufficiently recent. And I don't think that the articles in The Nation or The Post, which appeared in the last few years, were particularly illuminating on that subject either.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for this discussion of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, its role in our society, and some of the criticism that has been raised about it. I'm afraid that there is not much prospect, however, in view of the questions that have been raised, that the questions will be met with much else but silence. Thank you very much. You have just heard Ephraim London, Osmond Frankel, and William Kunstler, attorneys, on this program. In the preparation of this program, WBAI sent letters to the Justice Department and the Federal Bureau of Investigation, inviting officials of these agencies to appear on this program. As of the date of broadcast, no replies have been received to these communications. This is Joseph Lyford.